All right.
Quantum computing is an interesting thing, and we'll see how it goes.
Perfectly. So we are in parallel computing world. Great to have you again, Burton.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's been, I don't know, a little over a year since we've had a great conversation. Now, you're coming to PDC to talk about parallel computing.
Talking about parallel computing and parallel programming, which is the hard thing about parallel computing.
Exactly. You mean you haven't figured that
everything
out
else
yet?
About parallel computing is easy except programming.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
At least the hardware guys think so. Uh-huh. Yeah, they build them. They say, why aren't you using more parallelism in your programs? And we say, well, you know. Yeah, so anyway, so it's a challenge. But I think we're making excellent progress. Since last time we talked, I think we've really seen, you know, the kind of things we can do with Link and with the stuff in Dev 10, mm-hmm. PPL and TPL and Concert and all that stuff. There's just been a tremendous amount of stuff that we've got for people to use now, and we expect to continue to work on that.
Now, what are some of the kind of the bigger problems that, you know, are still kind of hanging over our heads as far as parallel programming? Right? I mean, we have the nice libraries and even some
Yeah, we have libraries stuff. And we have ways to make it relatively easy. I mean, I think one of the big problems is, number one, we have a variety of languages available now. Just Microsoft has quite a few, and there are other people with other languages. There are all the languages for GPUs that people are coming up with to do GPGPU, as it's called.
Yes.
Stuff. There's stuff that Intel has developed for parallel programming, and Apple has some stuff in the market, and so on. So there's a wide spectrum of choices for an application developer to use. And so that hasn't narrowed down yet a whole lot. There's a lot of existing applications that maybe the owners of, the people that are responsible for them, would like to, you know, get to run a little faster than they do today on future hardware. Mm-hmm. And so they need to be thinking about that. And some of them will go earlier than others. Some of them will say, well, let's get into parallel computing, and others will say, well, let's wait for a little while. It depends on what your competitors are doing. It depends on what stage you are in the life of your application, and so on. And I think we're going to start seeing that kind of thing happen now. Mm. And then we have more language things to do. I mean, one of the things that's fairly interesting to look at is the relationship of functional programming to the parallel computing space.
Yes, let's talk about that.
So it's really interesting thing. So back in the day, back when programming was young or something,
yeah,
there were some people who thought very highly of functional programming. For example, there was a guy you may have heard of named John Backus.
Yes.
The author of Fortran, or at least one of the main authors of it, and also the Backus of BNF. He and Peter Naur developed a language for describing the syntax of other languages. And he wrote a very important paper when he won the Turing Award. This paper was entitled, Can Programming Be Liberated from the Von Neumann Style? And the thesis of this paper, which appeared in Communications, the ACM, is a big deal, and is well worth a read even today. The essence of this paper was that we need to get away from this idea that computers should do one instruction at a time, one after another. Instead, we should allow multiple instructions to be executed at the same time. And his argument was that the way to accomplish that was through this thing called functional programming. And he had a programming language that he was proposing in this paper called FP, for functional program, I guess, for functional programming. And this was a pure functional language that allowed one to express, you know, just a wide variety of algorithms, and be quite confident that these things could execute in parallel on a reasonable parallel machine. So he was hot after this idea, mm-hmm. and a lot of us caught the bug, if not then you know, more or less then. There was a lot of interest in this area at the time. And so the idea of using functional programming to program parallel computer systems is a fairly old one. It goes back a long way. It didn't catch on. It didn't catch on. Why didn't it catch on? Well, there's various arguments you could make why it didn't catch on. I mean, one argument is that the functional programming community, the people that were really interested in functional programming for its own sake, mm-hmm. Had a pretty theoretical bent to them. They were sort of interested in very high-level ways of expressing algorithms. And they maybe took the language above the level at which even the above-average programmer could handle it.
Yep.
Right?
Sure.
So I've seen some functional languages that are really, 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 really easy to use. Like Excel, for example, which is a functional language of an unusual kind, but nevertheless, that's what it is. But the functional programming people, the people that advanced the art and got us to understand more about what their capabilities were and implemented them and so on, were not interested in languages that were that mundane. They were interested in much more expressive, much more terse languages that could say a lot in a very few character strokes.
Like Haskell?
Like Haskell, for example. Not to pick on Haskell, because Haskell is a great language, but Haskell is not the only possible functional language that one could imagine. And yet, if you talk to the programmer on the street, whoever that is, you know, and you say functional language, immediately his mind rushes to something like Haskell.
Sure.
He says, oh my God, I could never cope with that. I looked at Haskell once upon a time and it was way too hard for me, and so I'm back into C-sharp or something.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's been one of the problems. I think the other problem is that functional languages aren't that easy to get to run in parallel, actually, when it boils down to it. When you actually go to do the work and figure out, so how am I going to compile this language in such a way that it runs efficiently on parallel hardware? You got two problems, I guess. One of them is that the hardware may not be quite as good at parallel computing as you'd like. One of the things about functional programming that's interesting is that it involves parallel evaluation of expressions. In fact, maybe that's a definition of what functional programming is. Is you have independent evaluation of arithmetic expressions or sub-expressions. And the values of those sub-expressions need to be communicated to other parts of the program. So intrinsically, functional programming is... Hey, look who's here. It's Eric Meyer.
It's amazing because we were just talking about functional programming and look who walks in.
Hey,
how are you doing?
You must have heard us in the parking lot or something.
Yes. Whenever I hear functional programming, the radar goes off. You know?
Exactly. So,
now, Burton just gave an interesting definition of functional programming, Eric.
Okay.
Maybe the parallel, he can explain what he
Well,
just
I just said it's the potentially, at least, parallel evaluation of expressions. Now, maybe that's not quite right, but maybe it's a parallel application of functions instead of the parallel. But we all know about function application and expression evaluation as being sort of related subjects, right?
Yes. So, like expression-oriented programming.
Expression-oriented programming, yes. That's right.
Good.
That's right. And what I was saying was that getting a functional program to actually run in parallel on real hardware has a couple of problems. And the first hard problem is that the hardware may not be as good at communicating values from sub-expressions to their parents as you would like. The problem is that if you try to send even something as simple as a floating point number from one core in a multi-core system to another core in the same socket, right, and you want to communicate that, let's say, 64-bit floating point number, you've got to go through a lot of trouble to get that done. I mean, you could sort of naively say, well, look, I could store it in memory, and the other core could load it from memory, and there you are. But how do you know when to load it? How do you know when it's available? So you have to have something that synchronizes the producer of the value, the computation that stores the value, and the computation that wants to load it. So how do you do that? How does the one that's going to load it know when to load it? Well, what do? You spin, you wait on some bit or other that's over here in the on the side, and you know, when the bit's set, then you know to go, wait, but how did it get reset in the first place? I mean, there's all sorts of questions that surround this very trivial issue of trying to get a value from one core to another core. We haven't done a very good job at computer architecture for this problem. Maybe it's because the view of parallel computing that most people have is that you've got state, you've got a bunch of bits in memory, and all of these cores all madly go and manipulate bits, and you know they have to stay out of each other's way, and they do that with locks. And so I've got this model that says I'm just manipulating the bits in memory. What one friend of mine calls rearranging the furniture. I'm rearranging the furniture in memory, trying to get a total computation done. And, you know, I just lock a lock, and then I do something, and then I unlock that lock, and lock another lock, and do something else. And there isn't any idea of passing a value from one computation to another. That's not part of that model. Instead, it's sort of mutating, changing what's in memory all the time. You know, I acquire a bunch of stuff, now I change it around, and I make it something else, and I say, okay, I'm done, and I unlock it. And that's, so I'm only synchronizing with myself in some sense. Anybody else that wants to access the same stuff, well, they have to observe my lock. And when they see I've locked it, they say, oh, well, I can't mess with that. And that's sort of how that works. Well, this is not functional, decidedly not functional programming. This is, in fact, the opposite of functional programming. I'm not sure what the opposite ought to be called, but I sometimes call it stateful programming or
dysfunctional programming.
Dysfunctional programming is not a bad idea. Yeah. Oh my God. Not a bad thing.
But like you touched on an interesting topic there, like you know, like even sending one value, like a floating point number, but that seems to be a big problem with like parallelization of functional programs, that it's very hard to control the, you know, the chunks. How big are the chunks that you do in parallel if you're doing this all, you know, transparently? Yep. And you take an expression, how do you know when to stop doing stuff in parallel?
I call this is the other problem I wanted to talk about, which is a thing I call the parallelism packaging problem. Most people who think about automatic parallelization think that the hard challenge is analysis. Now, analysis is easy. It's synthesis that's hard. It's trying to actually manufacture an executable program from this thing that will run and not have too much overhead, not be too expensive on the hardware you have. And this is a challenging thing. So we have a sort of a blunt tool in the form of the hardware's ability to do this, and then we have this rather interesting, challenging problem involving how coarse should the granularity be. Now my, you know, the way I like to think about these things is that computation should be coarse-grained enough to amortize the overhead of communication and synchronization. So, you know, so if...
But that's easier said than done, right?
Well, that's right. So, yeah, I mean, so first of all, you don't know how many operations are going to be done unless you can elaborate the computation graph in advance. This is one of the reasons that you and I disagree mildly about the value of strictness.
Yep.
Right.
Well, let's talk about that.
All right. You want to talk about strictness? You want to? Why don't I make the case for strictness, and then you can make the case for non-strictness.
That sounds good. Perfect.
So a program is strict, or let's say a function application is strict. Let me be more specific. So I got a function f, and it's got a bunch of arguments, and I want to apply the function to the arguments. Okay. To get the answer. A strict language requires that all of those arguments be evaluated before the function is applied to them. So if I'm computing, let's say, 2 plus 3, and where the arguments are 2 and 3, as it turns out, I have to get the 2 and the 3 before I say plus. And so that's the way a strict language kind of looks. the cool thing about a strict language is that by applying this problem, applying this principle recursively, you get an idea of how much work there is because you're generating the code to do all this. Now, it isn't perfect necessarily, but it's a much, much more accurate sort of representation of how coarse-grained the computation is. So one of the reasons I like strictness wherever possible, using Eric's own argument about dynamic typing versus static typing, so strictness where...
possible laziness
where necessary, is kind of the attitude I have. But please, go ahead.
Yes. So I think, you know, the main problem with strictness is that it's a side effect. Strict evaluation is a side effect, and so it destroys equational reasoning. So
there's a blank whiteboard here. So, for example, if I have a function application f, you know, say f of x, and I define that as, you know, return 13. Okay, in a strict language, when I kind of, you know, have f of e, I cannot replace this by 13. Because,
you have to evaluate
you have to evaluate this first. But e might not terminate or throw an exception. So you cannot do equational reasoning. I cannot replace equals by equals. I cannot replace this application by its definition. So I first have to say, you know, x equals, you know, the value of e, and this must terminate. And then I can do f of x, which then goes to 13. And now if you look at this, this is exactly like a monadic bind, where I first have to kind of do the effects that that are involved with E, get the value, and then I can pass it in.
Right.
So
right.
You're kind of prescribing an evaluation order.
Right. So this is not a good thing when E has any effects at all. And
yes.
Throwing an exception is a particular kind of effect.
Yes, it's a very nasty effect.
Depending on what one's semantics are for exceptions, which is another thing you probably ought to talk about.
Yes.
But with the conventional semantics for exceptions, you're right. There's no way you could return 13 until you know whether E is going to throw an exception or not.
Yes, and then, so let's push that one on the stack.
Sure.
Because now the thing is, like, when you have a lazy language, and now if I have two arguments, so F, E1, E2, because I've abstracted from the order of evaluation, I can evaluate these in parallel, no problem, because, you know, the semantics doesn't say anything when these things are evaluated. Whereas in if you're strict, now you usually have to say, you know, you evaluate this one before that, or you have to kind of...
In fact, if the language allows effects of any kind in those expression evaluations, then it probably is going to tell you what order it evaluates its arguments in, because otherwise you can't reason about those effects.
Yes.
This has caused various people who are otherwise fans of functional programming to tear their hair out. They say, well, I really would like to have functional programming, but I'd also like to have a few side effects in my programs. And then they discover that, well, so they can't really reason about the order of the effects if they're lazy, and they can't really reason about referential transparency or equals substituted for equals in the case it's strict. So they're stuck.
Yes.
They're stuck either way. And it's a very nasty situation. So the question is, what can we do about it?
Yes.
One thing to do is to just not have any effects at all. And that maybe can be done. One thing to do is, I mean, if E1 and E2 are themselves free of effects of the usual kind, that is free of mutating state of memory, then there's still this question of exceptions.
And of non-termination, because
if
depending on which one you evaluate first, you might get stuck.
Yeah, it might be an infinite computation that causes the whole computation to diverge and so on.
Interesting. So, but let's talk about exceptions first, because
what about exceptions? So this is a very interesting problem.
Yes.
So if you think about this, this expression evaluation in parallel thing, everything is being all the flow of computation is being carried by passing values around among these subcomputations. So, and in fact, one subcomputation is done maybe in a completely different place at a completely different time than the computation that uses that value. So how in the world could you reason about the usual sort of exception machinery that most of us think about, where you essentially throw an exception and there's something that catches the exception that's somewhere in the control flow path of your program. Maybe you have to go winding down the stack to find this thing. That doesn't make sense in a functional setting at all. It just doesn't make sense at all. So, in fact, I'll give you a worst case. Suppose you're communicating with the cloud. I've got a service in the cloud, and I want to get some bits from that service. I ship the cloud some bits, and back comes some result. Suppose the service in the cloud found something exceptional. Suppose it couldn't actually give me the answer to my query or handle my request at all. Suppose instead it had to say, you know what, this thing you're asking for doesn't exist anymore, or I can't perform this service. It involves division by zero or computing the square root of a negative number or some other horrible thing that I don't know how to do, and therefore I have to give you an exceptional result. How does it do that by causing you to go back winding through your stack? Well, it doesn't know anything about your stack, right? So in some sense, exceptions from E1 or E2 or whatever need to get plugged back in F, and F has to be written in a way that says, well, if an exception occurs, then something happens. So F of X just says return 13. I guess you're guaranteeing in that case that X doesn't generate an exception.
Well, in my lazy language, it doesn't matter because, I don't...
Well, you didn't say anything that said what to do in case,
But what this says is like the result doesn't depend on X, so that I don't care if it has an exception or not.
Right. So you'll still return 13?
I will always return 13.
No matter whether there's an exception or not.
Yes.
But well, is that actually like? Is that
this is sometimes called the forgetful functor. This is the thing. That, yes. This is the thing that doesn't care what its argument is. Right. It's just going to return 13. I'm sorry. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So if that's what the meaning of this lazy program is, f of x body of it is return 13, then what's the strict equivalent of that?
Yes.
You're right. Yep. And the strict equivalent of that has to be something like, if X is exceptional, then, return 13. Otherwise, return 13.
But wait a minute. What happens in the case where, what if your function was f of X?
Yep.
It returns 5 plus X.
Charles is going to make life hard for me. Okay, let's call that G. G of X.
Give it a different name,
And then that way we can use X here. And then you said to return
X plus.
X as in an expression.
X plus 5.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in that case, well, definitely I need X to compute the result.
Yeah.
So in a lazy language, now you can say, well, if you're doing analysis, now you know you can see from here that you need X, so you could evaluate X strictly.
So this is strictness analysis. So this is a way to generate strictness in an otherwise lazy or lenient language.
Yes. Right. But the thing is, like, what do you do with exceptions? So in some sense, in a lazy language, you cop out of exceptions. What you say is that if this thing has an exception, it's the same as non-termination. Right. It's like you ask this thing to be evaluated. Suppose I now call G of 1 divided by 0.
Yeah.
Right? So in the lazy language, you kind of treat this as non-termination. It never comes back. So the result of this thing, well, you say that is bottom. Well, the result of that whole thing is bottom too.
Right.
And you don't distinguish between exceptions and non-termination. And there are special forms of non-termination that you can observe, but then we're talking about...
Well, I spent a few weeks as a computer when I was an undergraduate.
Yes.
As a computer,
I was a computer. I was computing cosines.
Okay.
As part of a computation to compute the radar albedo of the moon.
Nice.
And I had a Mershon calculator with a multiply accelerator on it. It was a very nice little machine. And one of the things I like to do for recreation, it would accelerate division as well. One of the things I like to do was to make it divide by zero and watch it run forever.
Yes.
So in that case, division by zero was non-termination. Yes. That machine never halted until you pulled the plug out of the wall or something.
But for distributed computations, that also makes a lot of sense because
sure.
How do you know that something went wrong you know, somewhere in the cloud.
You don't know.
So I think equating non-termination and exceptions is a kind of very productive thing. But on the other hand, I think what Burton said is when you treat values as exceptions, I think that's where you were heading, right?
Yes, that's right.
That you say, well, if f of x, if you want to deal with exceptions, well, you have to somehow encode that in the value here that this
that's
can
right.
either be an integer okay. or a value of an exception type.
That's
so,
right. And there may be varieties. There may be flavors of exception
yes.
types.
Mm-hmm.
And those flavors may generate different behavior by the customer, right,
okay.
by F. So F says, well, there's various ways X could go
yes.
south on me. I mean, it could do this, it could do that, it could do the other thing. Sometimes I might as well call it bottom. I might as well say it's non-terminating yes. behavior and forget it. Other times, though, I may have fallback strategies. I may be able to do something else. I may be able to compute it another way. Maybe I want to tell my customer. In other words, I'm being invoked by someone else,
mm-hmm.
and I'm passing the thing along. I get something back. Maybe I want to propagate it. Maybe I want to tell the human that actually is wanting this to be done that, I'm sorry, this web service just gave me a FUBAR exception, and the FUBAR exception is something you're going to have to cope with, Mr. Human. I can't deal with it.
Sure.
So it gives you the ability to deal with that. But this is a point of tension. But remember how we got here. We got here because of Eric's comment that it's very hard to decide how to package the parallelism, especially deciding how to make it big enough so you can afford
yes.
the overhead of communication and synchronization. Now, of course, my favorite approach is to just drive the cost of communication and synchronization so far down that you simplify your life a lot. And we haven't successfully convinced the microprocessor manufacturers of the world to do that, but we may one day. But absent that, we need something else.
Yes, but is that really realistic? Because even there, you still have latency. I mean, you still have to send the values over a wire. So
yep. So you still have latency.
Yes.
If you have concurrency in the things that use wires. Then, and you have enough bandwidth to keep a pipeline of things going, then you may have a way to overcome that. Otherwise, there's a problem there as well. But I think that, the first order problem is what do we do about language design, strictness analysis, and strictification, and how do we what's the right trade-off among those things? And I don't know yet. it's too hard.
Yes,
too hard for me.
Yeah. So are you ready to kind of talk about monads? Because you invented monads here. Because this thing by saying that this is not just an integer but something that is like an exception or an integer.
Exactly.
You've introduced monads.
I have. It was accidental, but I did it anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what Burton did is he he distinguished between a value
yep.
of type int and a computation of a value that can throw an exception. So that is
right.
So that would be the exception monad, exception of t. And then mm-hmm. the computation now, instead of going from t to s, say, it goes from exception of t to exception of s.
Right.
Right? And so this is like,
right.
the trick is to kind of, to really encode in your types
yeah.
what the effects are. And one of yeah. the possible effects is that you can throw an exception.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
so I would argue, when we do go back to the laziness versus strictness,
sure.
you want to also say, if it's strict, you want to say that there's it's like lifting or something, you have an effect, because you say it's not really the value, but I want to compute the result. So it's like,
right.
So, and in that sense, now you can see from the type that this thing might diverge.
Yes. Yes.
Because you will kind of
yes, if that's the appropriate behavior, and it might not be, and it might
yes.
not diverge. I mean,
yes.
These are all things that we could have our choice about. Now there's another thing going on here, and that is that there are also programs that do have control flow
mm-hmm.
still in the world, in the wild. We're not in pure functional programming yet,
yeah.
and so we have all sorts of interesting concepts. And it might be that we need to go back and forth from exceptions as values to exceptions as control flow modifiers. Exceptions as control flow modifiers is what we have today, mostly.
Yeah.
Exceptions as values is what we've just been talking about. And I think we probably need to be able to convert smoothly from one to the other. So if I have an imperative program written in C++, mm-hmm. you know, I would like to have sort of normal exceptions in my C++ program. If I invoke some service and I get back a message that says, I am an exception of type whatever, then I would like to turn that into something that a catch might be able to deal with at some point in my control flow-oriented program. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, I actually produce another message for somebody else, and I had an exception inside my C++ program, or maybe I had inherited from the message we were just talking about, one or the other, I have an exception that I can't handle. Who do I talk to, right? I'm just sitting here, a little self-contained thing. I received a request from somewhere. I forwarded on my version of that to wherever it was. I got back something that was exceptional. Now I have to report it back. I need to convert my control flow back into an exceptional value somehow for the recipient.
You know what's interesting? This is what a lot of native programmers already do. Because, you know, you often see SOK equals, you know, if SOK, so they do that, right?
Yep, yep.
They make a call already. And it returns a status code, which is like, you know, exceptional value.
Yep.
And then you might draw a real exception or you might catch an exception and then return that value from your function. But it's rather painful to do right now.
It's painful, but we've seen this before. We've had this before, especially in programs that attempt to be robust about all the cases that can happen. And I'm just suggesting that maybe one of the futures that I see in programming languages is some way to deal with this a little more smoothly, to do a little better job at simplifying the task of writing programs that actually manage exceptional cases.
Absolutely.
So one thing that would help a lot is having type signatures that convey this information so that when you actually plug into a service, okay, it returns something of a monadic type that includes this exception possibility. You can say, oh, I never thought that could happen. Well, and now I have to cope with it on my end, and that's the behavior you want.
But what about the case where the exception that happens is caused by the environment? So out-of-memory exception is not something that the program flow should ever want to do anything with. How are you going to design a monadic structure for out-of-memory exception, something that happens on the system that you're running? You have no control over that pressure, that problem.
Definitely.
What are you going to do?
But I think you're asking for something that's, like, in my view, an artificial distinction. Because, you know, if I call a function, now that might cause a division by zero, and that throws an exception back at me.
Right.
Or it might run out of memory as the kind of, you know, the callee of that, or sorry, the caller of that function.
Yes.
To me, it's both something that's caused by this function, and if that, where that exception happens. So that's one point. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, yes, if it's an out of memory exception, there's very little I can do about it. But it's still caused by calling that function. And now the only thing I probably do is just kind of throw up my hands as well and just propagate that exception upwards. So.
Well, that's right. And so all we're talking about here is being able to propagate the exception to someone who may or may not be able to handle it. But, you know, you can't. Now, that said, sometimes you can handle it. Mm-hmm. If you're out of memory, well, get more memory.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds stupid, but...
Certainly.
But, I mean, but...
I guess the distinction I was trying to make is that you have the exception that's thrown during what the function is computing, as Eric was talking about. If the function takes an int and does something with it and it happens to throw an exception because you can't divide, you know, 0 by 1 or 1 by 0, whatever, obviously 1 by 0, that's different than the system telling the executing code that, hey, I can't do anything anymore, so nothing you want to do is going to work. Everything's going to throw an exception.
Well,
it's a black box, right? I mean, I'm calling this thing, and it will now start kind of, you know,
exactly. Right.
And I don't, you know, I don't really care how that happened, if that was an out of memory thing.
Okay.
So, and again, what Burton said, maybe on the outside here, there's something that kind of looks at this thing at a different level, and it can say, oh, this was out of memory. Oh, I plug in some more memory, and
I do it somewhere else.
So out of memory might not be as bad as you think. Because it's at some layer of your computation. Right. That's a normal thing. Right. It's like division by zero.
Okay, so let's try to bring this back to the parallelism talk.
Yeah.
I mean, in the sense that... I mean, I think a lot of people program with, you know... I know in Java you have throws where you can tell people, I'm going to throw sections of this
in
type.
Spec sharp.
And spec sharp and stuff like that. But let's talk about if you figure this all out, how does this benefit parallel computation? I mean, parallel programming.
Well, so number one, programming sometimes goes wrong. Right? And if you're in a world where you're sending messages around, we need machinery to deal with this. And in fact, software plus services is a good example of just such a world in which we have to worry about this. If we're getting services done by other places, other computers, maybe located in the cloud or somewhere, bad things can happen there too, right? And so we need this as part of that model. So in some sense, distributed computing and parallel computing in functional style are actually quite related to each other. Not to say that distributed computing is always free of effects. It doesn't have to be purely functional. But it is centered around this idea of sending messages that is part of the problem with this model. But let's get back to what happened to the functional programming parallelism promise that John Backus talked about, right? What happened to it? And one of them was the fact the hardware really wasn't perfect for this. The second problem was the one that Eric and I started talking about a while back, which was it's not so easy to get it coarse-grained enough to make it efficient to do. There's a related subject, which is what you might call the nested parallelism problem, which is that there's parallelism there, but in order to package it up, you need to do some extraordinary things to orchestrate the computation that you wouldn't normally think of needing to do. And these are transformations to the program that you want to do that essentially generate parallelism where none existed before, at least didn't seem to exist before. One of my favorite examples of this is the scan operation, which is also called parallel prefix computation. And this is a colleague of mine here at Microsoft said, God, it was a wonderful talk you gave. You showed me something impossible, and then you showed me how to do it. The impossible thing is, how do you compute in parallel all the partial sums of an array or a list of inputs? I've got a sequence of integers coming in, finite sequence, and I want to compute all the partial sums of it. Well, it's nothing easier, I guess. I mean, right, I just maintain an accumulator, and every time a new number comes in, I add it to the accumulator, report the result, and keep going, right?
Sounds like reactive programming.
Sounds like reactive programming. And in fact, that may be the right way to do it. But it's not very parallel, is it?
Yep.
So how do I do that in parallel? Well, there is a way to do that in parallel that relies on the fact that the operation is associative. And what you do is you group it in other ways so that you can do partial sums and sort of combine them in a wonderful way to actually generate all of the partial sums, that is, all of the prefix sums, as they're called, summation from I equals 0 up to j of a sub I, and you report that for every different j. And you can do that in parallel without more than a constant factor more work, and in a time proportional to the logarithm of the number the logarithm of the size of the input. If you have an infinite number of processors, if you have a finite number of processors, then it just speeds up real as fast as you want. But it isn't infinitely fast, obviously.
Should we draw the picture for that?
Sure, we could draw the picture.
So this is like a trick that you know the parallel guys often do, right? They exploit algebraic properties. So if I have A plus B plus C plus D, let's do that. Yep. So if it's if you're doing it like this, now you have to kind of go and do it sequentially. But if you use that as associative, now I can do, plus of A, B, plus CD. And now I can do, you know, can do these
things in parallel. So now I've generated A plus B plus C plus D in two layers. And now I got A plus B here, so all, now all I need is A plus B plus C, right? And, you know, so you could modify this thing a little bit. My favorite scheme for getting all the partial sums sort of looks like this, A, B, C, D. It's called cyclic reduction. And the idea is that you essentially do this. And sure enough, B plus C is here, and then I add A to it, so that does that. And here's the little tree that Eric drew for this guy, and A plus B is part of that tree. So that does the whole shooting match. This requires, if this there's N inputs, it requires log N layers this way, and N log N operations, but there are even cheaper ways of doing this than this that... you can go look up. But anyway, but this is the kind of thing that can help you in A, finding parallelism where you didn't think there was any, but also in restructuring computations to use this thing to coarsen the granularity of the processing you're actually doing. So for example, you can implement sparse matrix vector multiply with a variant of this scheme that treats essentially the sparse matrix vector multiply as just one big inner product. You can almost think about it as you're taking rows of the matrix times this column, but the rows are very sparse. But what you do is you just say, well, I'm just going to treat it all as one big stream of stuff. I'm going to let each element in the array pick out what the thing it wants to multiply itself by, and then return that. And all I have to do is just break the addition chain every once in a while. Just do the partial sums of a sparse row by the dense column, and keep all those separate, but essentially orchestrate the computation as one big thing. So this is using an algebraic transformation to package the parallelism of a computation. Otherwise, the parallelism would be in little bitty chunks, little bitty pieces. It'd be harder to deal with. So that's one of the techniques we can use. There are probably some others that we haven't found out yet, but these are things that we can do.
So one thing that always kind of surprised me, because if you look at this, in order to kind of refactor the computation, it's kind of obvious that if there's side effects, that will be really hard. If there's no side effects, then I'm free to do this.
Right.
But people do these techniques, you know, they pioneer these things in like Fortran, where they take very imperative programs. So what is the trick there?
Well,
how can they
trick?
Do that? Amazed by that.
Well, it wasn't so hard, you know. I mean, we did it in Fortran because we knew we were writing functionally. So there's a very interesting thing that goes on in Fortran. Most Fortran programs are functional or close to it at some level. And when they're not functional, they're nevertheless, the subcomputations are isolated from each other. And the reason this is especially true of Fortran programs is two things. One is, it's very easy to analyze Fortran programs to understand what's going on. The expressiveness of the language is restricted to an extent that allows you to figure out what computations are going on and exactly what memory locations or what values are being accessed in the compiler at compile time. So you don't have to, you know, do anything fancy with that. The other thing is that programmers came to rely on these on this language, especially for vector machines, to automate the process of generating code, automatic vectorization, basically. And so they would write programs in a certain style that the compiler could, in fact, package the vector instructions from. And by doing that, they were able to get high performance in a high-level language, and the only price they had to pay was that they had to be circumspect about where they would have these side effects. In fact, if you had a side effect in there, had something that the compiler didn't understand, it didn't take much for the compiler not to understand it, the compiler would just, you know, essentially reject your program and say, I can't make this run in parallel. I'm sorry, it's going to run really slow. Or, in fact, normally it wouldn't tell you anything. You just run it, and you discover it's very slow, and then you say, oh, yeah. And then you'd use some sort of tool, or maybe you get annotation from the compiler listing that told you where the parallelism was and wasn't. You'd say, oh, I thought this was parallel, but it's not. What happened? And then you have to go figure it out. So that's sort of how that happened. What's interesting is it wasn't really a completely functional model. The other thing was that it had effects, it had side effects, but they were totally isolated. In fact, they were isolated at the level of iterations. The classic Fortran program is either functional or it has effects, but the effects are isolated within each iteration. Hmm. So I write, you know, a sub I plus equals something or other, some expression or other, on iteration I. And I do that for lots of different A's, for lots of different values of I, basically. But they're all isolated one from each other, and I can run the loop in parallel because of that isolation and because there's an implicit assumption of atomicity. That is, there's no exception being thrown by any of those subcomputations. But as long as that's true, then the compiler is free to parallelize the loop. It still interferes with transformations like this, of course, because the transformation we're talking about here on the board actually reorders the computation in such a violent way that you might not be able to reason about the effects. But for pointwise effects in a loop, basically the assumption was, well, these are transactional. They're isolated atomic updates to the state. And so even though they're updating state, and even though, you know, I have to worry about that, nevertheless, I know that these operations all commute with each other because of that.
So you made a very interesting kind of side remark in there, is that Fortran, because the expressivity is limited, it's easy to, you know, analyze. Isn't that also one of the problems with languages that we have today, is that they're too complicated? Like, for example, if you look at the functional language that has higher order functions, the moment you have higher order functions, now, you know,
it becomes very hard.
It becomes really hard. So
this whole strictness analysis that we were talking about becomes very difficult.
Yes, exactly. So should we go and, like, adjust our languages to be better understood by tools and by...
I think the parallelism packaging problem, as I called it earlier, would be greatly simplified if the languages didn't aim so high. Now, there's some higher order functions that we'd really like to have, I guess, and the question is, so how harmful are they? I mean, map is an excellent example.
But right? Now the question is, are they really used as higher order functions? Because usually they're not used at, like, second order level. Like you use map, but you pass it a function, but that function itself is not a higher order function.
That's right.
So it's really only kind of second order programming
That's right. And even then, I mean, there's some other things too. So how often is it that I do a map and the function I'm applying is manifest? It's available at the point of call. It's a lambda, and
always
that happens all the time. And so and that's an easier analysis problem as well. So I think there's a lot to that. I think there's a lot to you know, before you arrived, we were talking about what happened to functional languages after FP, and one of the comments I made was that, you know, I mean, FP was nothing compared to where we went after that, because the language theorists and the people that really were interested in very expressive and very powerful languages got a hold of the functional programming paradigm and took it in a direction that was somewhat opposite to the direction that the practitioner of programming was likely to pursue. And it's not universally true. There are examples of the opposite direction, but nevertheless, I think there's a lot to that. And certainly the simpler the language and the more strict that it is in the right ways, at least, the easier the analysis becomes and the easier the packaging problem becomes.
Okay.
Interesting. But yet so many people adopted like C++, and I mean, it's such, that's a whole other discussion in and of itself.
Yes.
The adoption of languages versus,
But maybe the problem is, the problem I see is that, like, even though, you know, we can use multiple languages, most people, are, I think, are more comfortable with one language. And usually, it's not only, like, you know, you not only have to do some parallel computation, but there's a UI, so there's many other things that your program is trying to do. And it's, at this point, I think, quite hard to kind of split up your code and do this in this language and that in that language. So maybe at least for me, that is kind of, you like to have like the whole package, and then it's easy to slip in this thing where you just add more and more features, and then you lose maybe the original goal that your language is easier to analyze.
Right. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe not, though. So there are some examples the other way. I mean, where you can think about mixing languages in a way that doesn't necessarily make it impossible to analyze. I'm thinking about Link here. This is a very interesting example.
Okay.
So some people think functional languages are declarative by nature. I don't agree. I don't think functional languages are really declarative out of the box, or most of them are not. Most of them prescribe the actions that are to be done and don't essentially, so put another way, I can't normally treat a program as a set of statements. It's a sequence in some sense, mm-hmm. right? And so, for example, if I have a let binding, or I have lambda binding of some sort, I have to make sure that the scope of that binding has the right stuff in there, right, that uses that binding. And so there's order in everything. A really declarative language is just a set of stuff, and you can do it it's just completely, all right? Link is very close to that. It's more like that than most. And what's interesting is, it doesn't mean that there's no dependence, or there's no I define something that something else uses. What it means, though, is that all of the computation is driven by that dependence, and not by anything lexical or anything having to do with the order in which things are written. You would think that mixing that with some language like C# would just be horrible, and yet it isn't horrible. It's actually, it works very well, and it's very interesting. It sort of gives you the ability to do purely declarative, as functional as you'd like it to be, sort of programming in the middle of C#, which is quite an achievement, I think,
you're
right.
Yeah.
Good work.
But you have to be a little bit careful there too, because it is quite possible to, inside your link expression, to write, like, you know, a side-affecting function.
Yes.
And there's nothing really to kind of, you know, hold your hand. So
that's right. So you're sort of on your own when you do that, at least at the moment.
Yes.
We might be able to improve the situation a little bit in some way, but that's right. That's right. So you can't. You can't treat Link as though it were C# and do everything in the same way. But nevertheless, you have a lot of power. I've seen other things done in that same style besides, let me call them query comprehensions, although Link is not as mundane as that exactly. But you can write other things, other kinds of languages in that general style, and embed all manner of things. And I think this may be a kind of a trend in the language story that we're going to see, and that is that what's really important is, if you're going to change languages, is to get the objects that one language references and deals with available to the other language in a fairly free way. So I can do a subcomputation, and I don't have to do anything sort of artificial to communicate between the fragment or the piece in one language and the piece in the other. It sort of happens. The type systems line up, the value systems therefore line up, and I can use the result of a subcomputation written in this alien language. That's a very valuable thing.
That's .NET. Right? I mean, arguably, that's one of the core...
So in some sense, in .NET, that is a little bit at kind of the at a more granular level. So in .NET, yep. I mean, I can take a VB program and a C# program, and they, since they compile to the same IL, they yes. can operate on that level. I think what we're talking about here is within the same language, within C#, I have a sub-language link expression,
okay,
and then it can communicate.
Or DSL,
another
yeah.
yes, another
and,
example.
And there could be 24 variables. 24 things, 24 IEnumerables that are propagated from the link out to C# or whatever, and the C# can have its way with all those things, and you don't have to write an argument list or invoke a function or anything like that. It's just available. Yeah. And this is very cool.
Yeah, and F# also goes even further in that, because there they have not only kind of link-style expressions, but also their async computations where you overload the F# syntax, but you can kind of, you know, plug in a different sub-language, and F# even has like its quotations. So there's a lot of kind of
there's
research
a lot of
in
lot
that
of very,
direction.
And there's a lot of very interesting mm-hmm. things that we have done and will continue to do in that space. I think this is a very exciting area.
Excellent. Well, you know, the PDC was going to, that panel is going to be awesome, right?
Well,
you're
I
on
know.
A panel.
We may have settled everything.
No, we haven't settled everything. Yeah.
Yes.
No way. That's the future of programming. We focus
yes.
on functional programming
yes.
here.
Yes.
Yep.
But I guess one question that, you know, most of the people sitting in the audience who are going to be watching this and
yeah.
watching the excellent panel that's happening at PDC are not functional programmers.
Yes.
And essentially you have no intention of becoming functional programmers.
Well, Now wait a minute. Now just wait a minute.
Let's talk about the
what
current
is, what set. What is this thing? So most people aren't baseball players either. But I know a lot of people that play baseball.
Yes, that's a good, very good analogy.
Right? A functional programmer, it sounds like you've got a hat that says functional programmer, and, you know.
Well, you do. It looks like that.
Get read into the functional programming fraternity, and from then on, you're allowed and entitled to call yourself a functional programmer. Let me tell you, that's not the way it is.
Yeah.
Everybody writes functional programs. It's just that they don't think about it that much.
Yes.
And in fact, I mean, I find myself doing very strange things. I sit down to write a program in C++, and I find myself writing in functional style. Why do I do that? Well, because of some various things. I want it to run in parallel, right? I need to manage the side effects of my program. So I do all kinds of things that I wouldn't otherwise do.
Fair enough.
I'm not a functional programmer. Well, except when I'm practicing programming, and then sometimes I turn into a functional programmer.
Yes.
But it's not who you are. It's what you're doing right now or today, right? That's mm-hmm. really all it is. So the question is, how can we bridge the gap between functional languages and these functional programmers out there that are lurking, waiting to use these things? And, you know, that's an important thing to look at, because the gap was made. We created a gap between the practice of programming and the world of functional programming. And now we have to close that gap back up and say, look, this is important for everyday programming, for parallel computation, which is, you know, arguably important in the world now. And so we need to make it possible.
And I would also say it's like a lot of people like to emphasize the differences. But if you look at pure object-oriented programming, mm-hmm. that's very close to functional programming. Because what is an object? Well, an object is a couple of methods packaged together. What is a method? That's a higher order function. So in some sense, object-oriented programming is more powerful than functional programming, because there you kind of talk about single functions. Here I can package up the functions with their state, and it's all isolated, exactly what
right.
we talked about.
Right.
Another thing, when you talk about immutability, we all know for security reasons, when you return an array from a method, you're not supposed to pass your array, because then other people can start messing around with it. So even there, people say, oh, I'm just copying that array, or I give you an IEnumerable or something like that. So
generating a value from an object.
Exactly. So,
and people do that, just, you
yes.
know. That's a functional programming idea, if you like.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what you're saying essentially then is, if you program in a functional style, or languages like C# enable that, they have through link, and there's more work that needs to be done in languages like that, or you just use F#,
Yeah. Or you write C++ in a functional way.
Or you use Haskell, or you do something, or you use something else. Yeah, yeah.
Fair enough. Then you'll get the benefits of parallelism without actually having to be as explicit, like using a library like Parallel 4,
sure.
or decorating methods like this can run in parallel, blah, blah, blah. It's just the way you compose will take care of that problem. So you're saying, in some sense, that's the solution for the future? Mm-hmm. Learn how to program in a functional style in languages that enable you to do so. Is that?
Yeah, there's the other end of the stick that has to be held up, which is that we have to follow through and automate the process of generating parallel code from those programs.
And what I would say also is that I would like to have more protection from the type system. So in some sense, if you look at what we talked about, like with exceptions and side effects, in order for the system to help you do things in parallel, you have to provide more information, and the type system can help. If the type system says this thing has a side effect or it can throw an exception, yeah. that will help the system to say, oh, then I cannot reorder because you're relying on the right. fact that this thing throws an exception, so you might catch this before that. And so I think the type system, there's a lot of things that we yeah. can do in the type system to make that richer and then convey information to the underlying system to do all the transformations.
And then one last question, so people have something to think about before the panel.
Sure.
I mean, do you think there will be new languages created?
Lots.
Excellent.
Lots of new languages.
Languages are still important, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, not only that. I mean, people have this strange thought in their brain that languages were handed down. I mean, they're, you know, we only get one new language a decade or something like that. I don't believe it.
Okay.
I mean, just look at the last... How many new languages do we have? Where did F-sharp come from anyway? Darn. Well, it came out of OCaml, which came out of...
ML. You know,
ML, which came out of Robin Milner wanting a language to drive his theorem prover or something. Mm. And every... People generate languages. Java's not that old. Mm-hmm. There's lots of languages that get created every day. And I think now when we have this revolution going on in the parallel computing space, it's not going to slow down. So I think there'll be new ways to write code and new ways to express algorithms in languages we haven't seen yet. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the examples we talked about. What about a functional language that is simple enough so the compiler can do a good job of generating parallel code for it? Well, maybe that's a different language than any that we have now. I don't know. But that's the kind of motivation that will cause us to look at new languages.
Perfect.
Yep, and I must say I agree with that. One of the things that why new languages appear is that when you see that you're writing the same kind of boilerplate all over again, you want to kind of formalize that as a language construct. Or if you want to kind of, you know, give the tools a handle to kind of, you know, do something with your code, you enforce that in the language. So I think it's inevitable that we have more languages if, you know, as the field evolves, and then the languages have to evolve with it.
Yeah.
We'll see that it's like weeds, right? You know, you cannot eliminate weeds. They will always come back. That's like programming languages.
How's this panel going to work if we keep agreeing with each other? Right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, fortunately, Eric's the moderator, so we'll make sure he, you know, and Butler's going to be on the panel.
Oh, yeah. Butler and I will definitely have a good time.
It's going to be awesome.
And Eric can throw me softballs.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Eric is an incredible moderator. I think everybody's going to enjoy that.
Yep. And I'm really looking forward to the panel.
Me too.
Excellent.
Should be good fun.
And also your talk, So you guys are going to have a big presence down there, which is awesome.
Good.
Thank you for your time again, Bert.
You're very welcome.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for, and your entrance was perfect timing.
Yes.
It's amazing.
And just, you know, because Burton, I'm, you know, a big fan of Burton, I have one of my special shirts.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So this is one of my vintage shirts. So
vintage?
Yes. Yeah.
Heavy, man.
Yes, I only use this once in a while, so...
Right on.
It's definitely bright.